KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on the Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. Larry Wilmore has written for some of TV's most beloved shows, including In Living Color, The Fresh Prince, The Bernie Mac Show, and Black-ish. But early in his career, he says the industry didn't know what to do with a Black comedian who didn't fit a certain stereotype.
When I was doing stand-up, what Hollywood was interested in was more of what the Def Comedy Jam type of comic was for Black comedians. You know, like you had to be from the ghetto. You know, you can't be too smart because you have to be streetwise. So who wants a smart political comic?
Larry Wilmore talks about his career, his controversial closing remarks when he hosted the 2016 White House Correspondents' Dinner, and his venture outside of comedy on Hulu's legal drama Reasonable Doubt. But first we banter. Stick around. It's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my associate in banter, Matt Bellany. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So as you well know, Wakanda Forever, as we speak, we don't know the number for that movie opening over the weekend, but we know big. Big is a good rough gauge. But Disney, you know, its stock went down after this past Tuesday. Bob Chapek, the head of Disney, reported earnings, and Disney missed estimates. They had added so many people to the streaming service, although it's always a complicated picture. They added 12 million. They're at 164 between ESPN and Disney Plus and Hulu. However, you know, the street, having pushed for streaming, as we've discussed, is now like not so keen on streaming. Certainly Disney lost a big number, over $1 billion in the quarter on this. Streaming is really expensive, and I don't think anybody's figured out how to make it work as a going concern where you don't lose money. Chapek said this is the big loss, and after that, it's not going to be the same, and we're going to be profitable fairly soon. But I'm not sure how attainable that is.
Well, and you're not alone. The market is certainly not sure how attainable that is because the stock dropped 10% on this earnings. And Chapek has set a very aggressive goal. He said that Disney Plus will be profitable by the end of 2024. That's not that far away. I mean, it's 2 years from now. And they've got a big deficit there to contend with because they've sunk more than $8 billion into this streaming service now, and they've not gotten the return on that. And the revenue per user of these subscribers is extremely low compared to the competitors that they're in this business with. You know, there's many reasons for that. I mean, they have all these subscribers in India that don't pay very much. Bob Iger priced the service very low in order to get market share very quickly because that's what the stock market was valuing at the time. There's been a complete about face on that. Now they are looking at profitability, and Disney is sort of stuck here with tons of subs, but people not paying very much. That's going to change in the U.S. very soon because they are raising the price of Disney Plus. It's going from $8 to $11 if you don't want advertising with it. And they think that the people who stay at that $8 price and want to take the ads are going to give them another revenue stream, which can hopefully help this service get to profitability. But it is a tightrope they are walking in. And at least for right now, the market does not seem to believe that Chapek is going to get to that other side by 2024.
Yeah, it is indeed a tightrope that any legacy media company with a streaming service is walking. The old businesses that threw off money are fading, like broadcast networks and in many cases theatrical windows. And meanwhile, this streaming thing is not really paying. And it's really, really expensive to keep coming up with those original programs to keep people from churning out. This is a problem that, as you know, also afflicts Warner Brothers Discovery. They also reported earnings. Their stock has been so low. That company is just strapped with debt and a very difficult time when, you know, again, this transformation is happening. The old stuff is fading and the new stuff ain't paying, but it's actually leading to losses. So I have to say I was struck when David Zaslav, the head of Warner Brothers Discovery, said, you know, he talked about we're gonna want to do another Harry Potter movie. He's putting a lot of emphasis on wanting to do theatrical and get the benefit of all the windows that you make money off of when you release a movie theatrically. But he mentioned a Harry Potter movie. I'd love to do one if J.K. Rowling is interested. That stopped me. I thought, wow, you know, he gave some numbers about how long it's been since there's been a Harry Potter movie, which weren't really correct. And, you know, he sort of erased the Fantastic Beast movies, which I think did not do anything to help the Harry Potter franchise.
I mean, if you look at the performance of the Fantastic Beasts movies, I think a lot of people would like to forget them because they are diminishing returns. And this last one was not very good. But, you know, J.K. Rowling has been involved in these movies. So it's kind of weird to kind of gloss over them. You know, this is a very tough situation on Harry Potter because, yes, if Zaslav could snap his fingers and get a new Harry Potter movie, of course they would do it. It's a huge franchise. But J.K. Rowling is still alive and has huge say and control over what happens to these characters. And if she doesn't want to do it, she doesn't want to do it.
Controversial. She's very controversial.
She is controversial now.
Talk about her views of, you know, whether trans people are really trans, you know, that she cannot get off that hobby horse. So right away, there's baggage in addition to whatever was diminished by the Fantastic Beasts stuff. You know, I feel like, yes, eventually you would want to reboot Harry Potter, but maybe it's just a little too soon. And maybe it feels to me like the kind of idea that someone who is not necessarily of Hollywood, you know, he's Zaslav is from Discovery, but not of this part of the business, thinks sounds great, but maybe a little more complicated than he imagines.
Absolutely. And I think he's just looking at the balance sheet and saying, oh, our DC movies do X, our Harry Potter movies do X, and everything else does a lot less than X. So let's do more of X.
Yes, let's do more of X, but it's not so simple. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, founding partner of Puck News. Writer and comedian Larry Wilmore has written for some of the most influential sitcoms of several generations, with credits on In Living Color, The Fresh Prince, The Office, and Blackish. He also created The Bernie Mac Show and was a co-creator of HBO's Insecure. Now serving as executive producer on Hulu's Reasonable Doubt, Wilmore is working in drama for the first time. Reasonable Doubt follows the life of Jacqueline Stewart, an LA defense attorney. It's loosely based on real-life lawyer Sean Hawley, who's represented celebrity clients and serves as an executive producer on the show. Long before Reasonable Doubt, Wilmore performed as a stand-up, but not in the mold of the Hollywood convention of the day. Here's a bit from his 1990 appearance on Fox's late-night show, Comic Strip Live.
Thank you very much. I was just up for part in a movie, and I didn't get it because they said I was too black. Now, folks, take a good look, man. Too beige, maybe, right? Too black's kind of pushing it, I think. But, you know, if anything, people always ask me what I'm mixed with all the time, you know. They go, are you mixed with something? I swear to God. But you had to be mixed with something, like I'm a secret recipe or something, right?
I read somewhere where you were saying that there was no model for the kind of comedian you were. There was a sort of a certain vision of what a black comedian was, and that wasn't you.
Yeah, and it kind of, what's interesting about that, it kind of shifted into that. Because when I was growing up, there was room for different types of black voices. You know, like Bill Cosby was a storyteller comedian. Dick Gregory was a political comedian. Flip Wilson was more of a vaudevillian type of telling jokes, you know, whereas Godfrey Cambridge was like a hipster comedian. Red Fox was, they called it the party records. He was like a blue, you know, type comic and told that type of stuff. Richard Pryor eventually became a different version of that. When I was doing stand-up, the business itself, showbiz, and what Hollywood was interested in was more of what the Def Comedy Jam type of comic was for black comedians. You know, you had that certain type of voice. And it seemed like they weren't interested in all those other types. You know, like you had to fit into one type. And Robert Townsend kind of lampooned this in Hollywood Shuffle, you know, where he talked about you have to be urban, you know, that type of thing. Or we want somebody Murphonic, kind of Eddie Murphy, you know, that type of thing. You know, like you had to be from the ghetto was a qualification. You know, you can't be too smart because you have to be streetwise. You know, you can't be book smart. You have to be streetwise, you know, all those sorts of things. So who wants a smart political comic like Dick Gregory? You know, nobody wants that, you know? Yeah. So that's what I was up against, that headwind of that change. So, which is for me, which is one of the reasons why I started writing and producing to try to create that space for myself.
Yes. And I feel like you eventually do get there, but at first you're doing, it takes a minute. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
I read this quote that when you were talking about In Living Color, which is one of your, I guess, mm-hmm. earlier jobs, it was the worst of times. It was the worst of times.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, it's a quote Dickens whenever you're talking about working on writing staff. It was the working conditions. You know, we had to pitch all the time new ideas. Like, trying to imagine thinking of a new TV show and all that entails. You had to do that every day, it seemed like, with all the pitches you had to do. You know, the working conditions were so tough. People got fired all the time.
Atmosphere of fear. Yeah, it sounds
like it was atmosphere of fear. But at the same time, people loved the show. It made this cultural impact and everything.
Right.
You know, but as a writer, you never really got the benefit of that. It seems so, you know, you were like in the trenches doing all that, you know, but everybody else seemed to be getting the rewards of it. But having said that, you know, I say tongue in cheek, of course, because there were a lot of great times in that. And I was happy and proud to be a part of that show. But it was the working conditions more than anything else that I was referring to in that.
Do you think it was worse than other places now that you had other experiences, or was you just because you were new to it?
It's partly because you're new and the pressure of doing that type of show. We were under the gun so much, but I've never been on a show where the demand was so high, was so demanding of material. By the time I got on a sitcom, like, I was used to coming up with all these ideas in a week's time. You know, I had to come up with 30, 40, 50 ideas in a week, right?
That's a lot.
Some original, some based on characters, whatever it was, you know. So by the time I was on a sitcom and all they needed was a couple of stories, and I'm like, what? I got 10 stories for you. Two stories. What are you talking about?
Let me give you more. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. So I was overprepared.
I'm going to just keep walking through the career. You've worked for these so many shows that are, I think, really iconic and important. Mm-hmm. And it's quite a resume. And In Living Color is, you know, iconic and important too. So, or that's where and so it began, right?
Yes.
But you go from there to The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. And I think you said you felt like you were a consultant to the white writers.
I love hearing my quotes.
I do this to people on the regular, and they're always like, oh my God, where did you find that?
Well, this is part of that is a comment on what Hollywood was like for a long time. And
right,
a lot of people don't
realize.
That's
interesting, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you were a black writer, you did not get to work on what I'll call white shows. You know, a white writer could work on any show, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So even though as a black writer, I knew more about white people in America than white people in America knew about black life in America, you know. So if anybody had, you know, could comment on both, it would be the black writers, you know. But that is a comment on how people felt about black writers, you know, that the opinion was very low. And I was keenly aware of that, you know. And many times all they required from a black writer was cultural touches and that sort of thing, you know, making sure something sounded authentic.
Right.
And that's sometimes those are the expectations. So a lot of that was very condescending.
Yes, I should think so. Like you represent the entire black people of America or something.
Exactly. It's like a room full of guys going, oh, you know, we're going to do this story that has a woman in it. Can we get a couple of women in here just so we know we're
too
not
true, I think.
Yeah,
funny,
and that's happened too.
True. Yeah,
that type of thing has happened too, by the way. You know, but it's a very condescending approach to collaboration and writing, and you know, it took a lot to get out of that. Part of my mission was to help to change that because I felt like the material that we did, with some exceptions, was always dismissed as subpar and was put in a certain category. And that's just the way that it was. They were called black shows, and that was not a compliment if something's called a black show, you know.
So it was automatically inferior because you wrote it?
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
Or because it was about that experience. Either one was the case.
Right,
you know?
Right. Tell me a little bit about Felicia Henderson on The Fresh Prince.
Felicia was great. We became fast friends on that. She was very inspiring to me because she just couldn't take it. I mean, she quit about halfway through. And I was we had so many conversations about what was going on the year we were there because Jeff Pollock was running the show and he was not equipped to be running the show. There was like a coup. Every day was so insulting. And she just couldn't take it anymore and quit. And eventually I did too.
You said to Will Smith, it's nothing against you, man. You're about to blow up, meaning his career, mm-hmm. but I can't work with your boy, mm-hmm. that being Jeff Pollock.
Right.
I got to bounce out of here. So
mm-hmm. That's what I said.
And it was just this patronizing attitude. I'm just trying to make sure we understand what the issue was.
Well, here's the thing. Not even to pick on Jeff Pollock, but showbiz is very comfortable with treating people in abusive ways and has been very comfortable with it. And I always felt like there's no reason why you have to take that. You know, people don't have the right to just assume you should be treated in an abusive manner by, you know, just because they're in showbiz. They don't have that right, you know. And, you know, I said, I'm a grown ass man, you know, you can't treat me a certain way. Mm. This was, by the way, my chief conflict at the Bernie Mac show was I was refusing to be treated a certain way, you know. And, you know, just because somebody's the head of a studio, I don't care. You know, I'm a person, I'm a human being. You don't have a right to be abusive, you know.
Yeah, I hope that's changing because, you know, there was a lot of it for a long time.
I think a lot of movements have helped change it. Me too, certainly in some ways. I think people have become more conscious of that. But showbiz was very abusive to people in many different ways. This is just one of the ways. As someone who eventually ran a show, I've always made it a point that that type of behavior would not exist on anything that I ran, you know. And I'm very conscious about that. I feel like I don't care that it's showbiz. You don't have the right to treat people poorly. You have no right to do that. I don't care if you're my boss. Sorry. I'll quit. I don't, you know, right?
I've done the same myself. Yes.
Yes. I'm raising a family. I'm a father. I'm trying to be a good example to my kids. You know, I got a life. You think showbiz is the thing defending me? Nope.
Coming up after the break, Larry Wilmore shares why winning an Emmy for the Bernie Mac show eventually led to his getting fired from the series. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes. Join Jacqueline Coley as she hosts a brand new podcast, Scene on the Screen. Meet the innovative people at NBC Universal as they share their journeys, inspirations, and the movies that define them. Each episode is an intimate and fun conversation about the impact of film. Scene on the Screen is available now wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. Larry Wilmore has worked on some of TV's most influential shows, In Living Color, The Fresh Prince, The Bernie Mac Show, The Office, and Black-ish. Now serving as executive producer on Hulu's Reasonable Doubt, Wilmore is taking on a new challenge outside of comedy, a legal drama. In Reasonable Doubt, Emma Yahtzee Corinaldi plays Jacqueline, or Jax Stewart, a Los Angeles defense attorney with big-name clients. Jax is Black in an overwhelmingly white firm, prompting her to make a pointed remark when one of her colleagues asks her to attend a meeting.
Jax, I think you should join. You're good at handling A-list clients.
You mean Black clients? I'm just messing with you, Terry.
Years before Reasonable Doubt, Larry Wilmore created and won an Emmy for writing the pilot of The Bernie Mac Show. So we were getting to Bernie Mac, which I fangirled when I met you years ago because I was a really big fan. And you talked about, I've seen you talked about this idea of talking to the camera. I feel like you said it was inspired by a PBS show about living in Edwardian England. That inspired the idea for Bernie, you know, Bernie Mac, for those who never had the joy of seeing it when it was really, really good, was, you know, he would sit and talk to the camera.
Sometimes a little fear is a good thing. Where it gets dangerous, America, is when you let it control you.
So this Edwardian PBS series, it was like people, you know, trying to live as they did. I think I saw that, actually.
Yeah, it was called 1900 House.
I think I did see that. But that inspired that. And he was such a fresh talent. And then you said at a certain point, I mean, you were really trying to do something you know, different and special. And then you ultimately are fired, and you said you lost Bernie's ear.
Yeah, the network and I never saw eye to eye on what the show was because it was so different. And it took me a long time to figure out what that was and the rhythms of it. I was doing unconventional storytelling. They just didn't quite get the show. In fact, after I was fired, I said in the press that we had creative differences. I was creative and they were different, was what I said. But there was also a contempt, too, that was there. And this was the thing I talked about before. I was never given the benefit of the doubt that I was doing something different. They always assumed I was incompetent and didn't know what I was doing, even though here we are winning every award. Somehow that mysteriously was happening. Yeah, I was some incompetent guy that didn't know what I was doing at the same time. So how those two things could happen is beyond me.
But, how disheartening. And then Bernie had his own demons, I guess. I mean,
yeah, in the second season, you know, after I won an Emmy, Bernie kind of felt, you know, that's when his demons kind of took over, like feeling that maybe I took something or stole something from him, which of course wasn't the case, you know, but that's his own kind of stuff, you know. So that type of thing is more understandable, honestly. That happens a lot. But the network thing to me is more insidious.
I feel like I'm just going to hopscotch through some. I mean, you know, The Office, The Daily Show. Uh-huh. These are just iconic shows. I'm going to touch super briefly on the 2016 White House Correspondents' Dinner. You said a line. I'm not going to say it. I'll let the line speak for itself.
Words alone do me no justice. So, Mr. President, if I'm going to keep it 100, yo, Barry, you did it, my did it.
You've probably been asked about it a few thousand times, but I'm just briefly, you no regrets.
No, absolutely none at all. I'm very happy that I did it. That last statement that I meant it not as a joke, but as a way to communicate something that was very important to me. And the way that I started that comment was, you know, because I'm the same age as the president, that we grew up in a world where black men couldn't even be the quarterback of a football team. Right. You know, and now he's the leader of the free world, you know.
Amazing. Of course, we're and paying that, the price now, but go
yeah,
ahead.
Yeah, I know. And so that's, I was having a public-private moment is how I call it. You know, in acting, there's a term called public solitude, you know. So it was this public-private moment of connecting and just acknowledging that, hey, man, I see you. I see you, I see you, I see you, my brother, was what that really meant. You know, thank you so much. I was very emotional when I first thought of that. So it's more of that type of moment. You know, and as a comedian, you're thinking of ways to, you know, you're going to, sometimes things are shocking or whatever, you know, but it was meant that way. And I felt that he understood the way that I intended it also, which means the world to me. And the people who appreciated it on the outside took it that way too. There were a lot of people that did not like it, both black and white, and that's fine too. I don't need agreement to, you know, have what I do be the thing that I want to do. I'm not really seeking agreement. But I was really also heartened by the fact that a week later, he was doing a commencement speech, I believe, at Howard. And he said, and as Larry Wilmore said last week, I'm like, oh my God, Obama's quoting me. You know, he didn't say that line, but he said, you know, a black man couldn't even be a quarterback. Like he quoted the part of the line that was important. And for Obama to bring that up a week later meant the world to me.
Wow, you know? How cool is that? He was really listening.
Yes, that to me was the validation that, you know, it was cool what I said with the president, you know, because I certainly didn't want to disrespect either the president or the office of the presidency while he was sitting there. But I did want to do something that might be uncomfortable and maybe shatter something, but I did not want to disrespect him either. And the fact that he said that to me went, whew, okay, he was cool. you know.
And now I will fangirl once again about Insecure because it's one of my, I was obsessed with it. My daughter's obsessed with it. We are big fans. I hope that was a good experience. I really do.
Yeah, Insecure was a short experience, unfortunately, because I say unfortunately, but right before I did Insecure, I wasn't doing anything, ironically. I just was tried something, didn't go. And my managers introduced me to Issa Rae. She had just gone over to HBO trying to do the show that she had tried before, I think, with Chanda's company, didn't quite work out. they knew that Issa had done Awkward Black Girl, but they thought it'd be good if she was with somebody who had done more TV, a little more experience.
Yeah, that was like a YouTube, I think. Was it YouTube where she did Black Girl?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
YouTube series. Mm-hmm.
And so I watched it and loved it and met with Issa and loved her even more and said, hey, do you want to just write this together rather than me just supervise? She said, yeah. And so we spent that summer in 2013 figuring out the show and unpacking it and all that kind of stuff. And it was so much fun. And we ended up writing about 6 different drafts of it, going through the process you do at HBO, which is usually a long process of getting something done. And in waiting to find the fate of it, ABC called and asked if I would help launch Black-ish because they were having some problems with the script, but they really liked it. They liked the potential of it. And I said, well, HBO's kind of taking their time. You know, maybe I'll use that window to try to help that. I met Kenya and got along with him. So I did the pilot of Black-ish.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I did the pilot of Black-ish while we're waiting to get notes after 6 drafts, by the way. So we've gotten a lot of notes, but we're waiting for the head of HBO to weigh in. And so it's just taking forever. And so while we're waiting on that, then John Stewart says, hey, man, you know, because Letterman quit and then Steve is going to go do that. And then, you know, there's speculation who's going to fill that slot. And John Stewart says, hey, man, you want to do this thing? And that's a whole story to itself, you know. And so I had the opportunity to do my own show. And so before we even knew if Insecure is going to be picked up, it was called Nonprofit at that time, by the way. Propheet. So I went to go do that. And so I wasn't able to stick with Insecure, the series. I kind of consulted for the first season from afar, but I never had the chance to be there day to day during the series, let's just say, you know.
But you're kind of, at this point, you're like the doctor in a way, right? Or the handholder,
the doctor. The godfather, a lot of different terms now.
Right. And I mean, you know, you go from Insecure to Black-ish to your own show. It's not terrible. it's not a terrible series of choices. So now Reasonable Doubt, which is, again, different thing. It's not comedic. It's a straight up drama. What intrigued you? Reasonable Doubt,
I had a deal at ABC, went back over there because, of course, they knew me from Black-ish and all that stuff. And so thought I'd go over there and develop. And I saw that Kerry Washington had a deal there. And I thought, oh, man, that'd be great to work with Kerry. Because you're looking at the other people that have deals there, like you might team up and do something. And we ended up connecting, and they were about to develop this idea based on Sean Holly, who's a lawyer.
A real person lawyer.
Exactly. That I'd be, you know, that'd be a good thing for us to collaborate on. So that's how we started in collaboration on that. And we developed that show for the network at first. We found Ramla Muhammad, who had worked on Scandal, and Kerry knew her well, to be the writer on it. And it was a great process, but it just didn't make it for network. And then I left ABC, went over to NBC. And in that time, I think somebody over at ABC Signature thought, you know, we love this Reasonable Doubt. Maybe it can be redeveloped for streaming, you know, and so called us back in. And we said, yeah, let's do it. We still want to do this. It's great, you know, and Ramla reimagined it for streaming. We all chipped in on that, and it became what it is now.
So do you think at this point that attitude that you described in the beginning has dissipated or completely or somewhat a little?
Yeah, definitely gotten better because there are more people in different areas of the business now. And it's not just controlled by one aspect of it. And people have shown that that's not the case, you know. So it would be silly to have that attitude. We see more executives, they're more diverse now. There's more people of color, women in different areas of influence in the business, whether they're directors of photography, which is important, producers, directors, line producers, all those types of positions are very important. It's not just writers, it's not just actors, you know. There are many different places of authority that you just need those breakthroughs in so people can just relax.
Yes.
You know, that type of thing. So I think it has gotten better, definitely.
Larry Wilmore serves as executive producer on Reasonable Doubt. The series is now streaming on Hulu. His podcast, Black on the Air, is available anywhere you get podcasts. Thank you so much for talking to us today.
It is my pleasure. Thank you so much.
And that's The Business. Joshua Farnham produced and edited today's program with help this week from Katie Gilchrist and Paul Smith, who also mixed the show. You can stream The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts on the KCRW app. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on the Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.